Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I see possible futures all at once. And in so many futures, our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
Kwisatz Haderach himself, Timothée Chalamet, in Denis Villeneuve's much-anticipated follow-up to his 2021 film. Did Villeneuve find the narrow path to satisfying the few Dune skeptics out there, Adam, including you?
Well, whoever had the idea to release spies into my theater was definitely on the right track.
Intriguing. Our review of Dune Part 2 and more on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Happy Oscars weekend to all who celebrate.
We cheers, share cheers.
Our picks on last week's show with guest Michael Phillips. Who will win, who should win, and who should have been nominated, depending on when you're listening to this. You may already know just how wrong we surely were.
There may have been some spice released in the room where we made those predictions.
Later in the show, Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 1950s, Round 1 results, and Round 2 matchups. Have you checked the bracket? Do you know where you stand today, Josh?
I saw that I don't have a perfect bracket anymore, Adam. I did see that. You will have to break it down in a little more detail when we get there.
Nor do I. Rear Window, Singing in the Rain, Seven Samurai, Sunset Boulevard, and more. They're Alive, all looking to be crowned the best film of that great movie decade. For more info or to vote, filmspotting.net/madness. And we'll also have details on our first Film Spotting marathon of the year. More info about our marathons is at filmspotting.net/marathons.
Let's get to Dune Part 2, the highly anticipated sequel that finally made it to theaters last weekend. This film introduces several new characters to an already large ensemble, including those played by Florence Pugh, Austin Butler, Christopher Walken, and Lea Seydoux. But it begins just where its 2021 predecessor left off, with Timothée Chalamet's Paul Atreides and his mother, Rebecca Ferguson's Lady Jessica, embedded with the Fremen, the native people of the desert planet Arrakis. Paul just might be the long-awaited Messiah, the Kwisatz Haderach, but for the time being, he is eager to earn his place among the Fremen, including a warrior named Chani, played by Zendaya.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. We don't have that here. Here, we're equal. Men and women alike. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Oh, Muad'Dib, Uzzel. Maybe you could be Fremen. Maybe I'll show you the way.
Now, if you're all in on Denis Villeneuve's Dune films, and many people are, judging from the response to Dune Part 2 on Metacritic, where the movie received, quote, generally favorable ratings from critics and, quote, universal acclaim from users, a reaction that pretty much matches what I've noticed scrolling by on Letterboxd, then hearing that scene between Timothée Chalamet's Paul and Zendaya's Chani might carry some movie magic. But for me, Adam, no bit of dialogue is going to truly capture what is special about Villeneuve's project. Like the first film, Dune Part 2 is a movie intricately envisioned and tactily imagined. Watching it, for me, is a bodily experience. I was trying to describe this when I wrote about the movie, and the only thing I could think of was to say that this is a film that gets in your nostrils. Consider another better scene, I think, between Paul and Chani. At one point, as their friendship begins to take the form of a courtship, Chani shows Paul how to sandwalk, randomly move about the desert so as to not attract the attention of the giant carnivorous worms living beneath. Villeneuve and cinematographer Greg Fraser shoot this scene at dusk from a respectful distance so that this potentially silly moment registers instead as a romantic dance number, or at least a pantomime of one. We have these two lonely figures finding an instance of connection in the vast, empty harshness of Arrakis. Dune Part 2 adds another element to the series' palette beyond the play of sand and light that we get in that scene. This time, water, too, is a recurring motif. Perhaps that's something we can talk about further. This, too, for me, had a presence I could feel while sitting in the theater, awash in the movie's sounds and images. Now, with the first film, Adam, such things weren't quite enough for you. Despite admiration for many of the production elements, you wanted more from 2021's Dune. While Part 2 certainly gives us more characters, more politics, more worms, more desert, but was it more of the right stuff? Did this Dune get in your nostrils, or have you yet to appreciate the harsh beauty of Arrakis?
No bit of dialogue, your line there. I see you've got Denis Villeneuve's talking points. Wasn't he out there on the circuit last week making waves because of a big interview where he explained that he hates dialogue, doesn't care about it at all? He's of course a visual storyteller. So
okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
it tracks.
Yeah, of course it does. And I was extremely optimistic after the opening of Dune Part 2. I thought the action was compelling enough. But what I really loved was a touch that suggested Villeneuve was going to continue doing something he did well in Part 1, I thought, and another that suggested maybe he was going to rectify a problem I had with Part 1, and both relate to Paul and Lady Jessica as they're separated from the Fremen during a Harkonnen attack, but it's the Fremen who ambush the Harkonnen, and they're high atop this desert cliff. When the Fremen shoot the Harkonnen, their bodies fall to the ground, and they almost fall on top of mother and son. They generate this tremendous thud, which just boomed in the theater. The sound design, as in Part 1, is one of the real achievements of Dune Part 2. It was that tactility we touched on in our discussion, our revisit of Dune Part 1. Not just blasting bad guys whose bodies disappear when they drop, there's still this physical threat, and that physicality, that weight that he gives those bodies, that's so crucial to Villeneuve's world building. Jessica then has to basically save Paul, save her son. At one point, he's being lined up in the gun sights of one of the Harkonnen. And after she saves him, she admonishes him. She tells him to never turn your back. I don't know what the exact line is, but never turn your back. She's really angry with him. It was Jessica being what she was in the first half of Part 1, which is this very formidable presence who is also a mother. And she's talking to him there just as a mother would. As small as it was, that moment to me suggested that her humanity, and what I mean by that is the full range of who she is, and that complex relationship with her son was going to be, hopefully, at the heart of this movie. Another relationship I needed to be invested in was Chani and Paul. And although I'm still not sold overall on Zendaya's performance as Chani, fast forwarding just a little bit, there is a moment she gets after, we'll just say Paul displays undeniably, even to a skeptic like her, that he is special. And lots of other people are watching as well. And her first reaction is to be thrilled for this man that she, I think at this point we can say, loves. Maybe it's actually her second reaction, Josh, because her first reaction seems to be joy that he didn't die, which was a very real possibility. But then we get a third reaction, and Villeneuve doesn't underline it too much. We just get this quick close-up of her face as she observes, and I'm going to use this word very deliberately here, very intentionally, as she observes the rapturous response of everyone around her, of the other Fremen. And without her or anyone else saying a word, we understand what she is understanding in that moment, which is that things will never be the same between them again. So you know Villeneuve will get the spectacle right. The question is about the human drama, those narrative stakes that I felt were introduced but not sufficiently developed in part one. It almost all connected in part two, Josh. It almost did. I never found this film to completely live up to the expectations it set by that opening and by that first opening, let's say 90 to 100 minutes. But it sounds like you're in a little bit of a different place than I am. The spectacle of it did carry the day.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of, you know, how much weight do you give to the things you appreciate and how much weight do you give to the things that are lacking? There are certainly things that are lacking in this film. I am not among the more rapturous reviewers of the movie that I've seen. I wish I could be. And I think we probably will share some of those things in common that held us back from being in that department. But I'm so glad you called out that opening. If 11-year-old me had seen the first 10 minutes of Dune, I probably would have been willing to like toss Star Wars away, toss Lord of the Rings. I mean, that sequence you described so well is beautifully rendered. How about even before the Harkonnen start falling, the way they float up that rock using their suits? It is happening. There, you could not convince me that that wasn't happening, that we weren't on this planet and that's what these people were doing. So that is, and it's more than just the action and the visuals. There are those character dynamics that you're describing as well that do pick up from the end of the first film that makes it such a standout sequence. And I'm with you that that's carried through for probably it was a good 100 minutes. There is the guerrilla attack sequence on the Harkonnen's harvesters that Paul and Chani are a part of. I think that is also not only brilliantly envisioned as an action sequence, but speaks to their dynamic, their relationship, which to me is stronger on screen as friends and compatriots in this struggle than as lovers. That does feel rushed. I'm not saying it's the fault of the performances, but I don't think the performances sell it either. I just don't know if it's given the time or the context it needs to register beyond the moment I described of those little touches that suggest a connection that the more traditionally prosaic romantic exchanges just don't. So I'll admit that. But these, I mentioned this when we revisited, you know, Dune a couple of weeks ago, the first film, is one of the things that I couldn't wait to see, now that I knew we were getting to the Fremen's world, was these places that they live, these sieges. And this is all in the first half of the movie, too, where we are introduced to these cavernous layers that somehow still allow light. It reminded me of, it was a couple of months ago, I was totally unfamiliar with this place until it was in a National Geographic story, but Alhambra, this Muslim fortress built in Spain, like around 1200, just this gorgeous, enormous complex. And you can see the influence of that sort of architecture in the production design of Dune, of this movie. Patrice Vermette, production designer here. There are just these, the Fremen live in these cavernous spaces that somehow by their shape invite the light just so to create what would be natural room lighting that is gorgeous. The inscriptions on the surfaces everywhere, and then these unexpected fountains or pools and gardens. This is all the stuff I was hoping for. And again, it's not simply visual. It speaks to this thematic portrait of the Fremen culture, not entirely, but largely being one of in tune with the surroundings, in tune with this landscape, rather than against it, rather than fighting it. You see this in the costume design too, right? They have to adapt with the nose things, but otherwise they're wearing fabrics and drapery that flows with the landscape as opposed to the Harkonnen, who are in these armored suits, and they need another great costume design detail, the fan on the back of the Harkonnen helmets that is spinning. I just love something like that. So this is all stuff that was just carrying. It is so well done. It's not just that it's done well, like The Creator, a recent film, which I think we mentioned in our Dune revisit. For me, the gap in something like Creator between the world building, which was excellent, and the narrative was too huge for me to entirely give myself over to The Creator, even though I liked it. Here, Dune, the expertise of this stuff I'm describing and how it does connect for me with character and theme was at such a high level that it does carry me over through that other stuff that is in the last maybe hour or so that gets in the way a lot of this. For me, it was slightly character, but also I think, Adam, motivation. I no longer could hook into the motivations of these various characters, especially the new ones who are introduced. Some of them are clear, but a lot of them are not, and they're contradictory, and not in a way that is ambiguous or, ooh, how is that going to reveal itself? They were just plain confusing for me. And both, you know, cards on the table, neither of us have read the Frank Herbert books, so we're coming at this, you know, completely anew. But those are the things that held me back. But I did want to spend time on these other elements that are so well done that it would take a huge failure in the last hour to lose me. And I don't think Dune Part Two fails in that way.
You mentioned motivations, and yeah, that's so crucial to everything I'm expressing when I talk about some of that human drama and really just drama in general. The narrative stakes rely on fully understanding and being fully invested in those character motivations. And I get it. If you're as taken with this world building as you are, it would be hard for it to really misstep in that last 90 or 100 minutes or so. For me, even with those awesome visual flourishes, there was no way to totally avoid the tedium that accompanies 17 more narrative threads having to be established. Some, you know, will carry over to the next movie when they're introduced. Some are being tied together here and being tied together here too quickly. And when I mention awesome visual flourishes, you eloquently described the sieges. How about the contrast? The contrast with the world of the Fremen,
and
Getty Prime. That choice that I'll just be honest, I did not devote enough time today to really thinking about how I wanted to articulate this, because there's probably a much more intellectual way to say it, Josh. I just noticed, of course, that even though it is this world that's completely devoid of color, literally devoid of color and completely machine-like, and its color palette is black and white and gray, somehow we get this choice here by Villeneuve when we get outside of the interior spaces of Getty Prime and we get into the open, like this Colosseum-esque showdown that we get. It somehow becomes even more monochromatic.
Yeah.
It becomes like something straight off of a black and white comic book page. And there's a part of me, Sam and I were just talking about this a little bit briefly today, something we agreed on over Slack, is that one of the downsides of this film devoting as much time as it does to a character we haven't mentioned yet, Fade Rotha, who's played by Austin Butler, and the Harkonnens as well, taking on an even bigger role in this film. One of the downsides is the world of this film then becomes a little gloomier, a little darker, and you don't have characters like Jason Momoa's Duncan Idaho to offset some of that a little bit in terms of just the humor and the lightness. Even Josh Brolin, when he reappears in this film, I was hoping for some of that lightness to come through in the relationship. I mean, I know, like Duncan Idaho, he's fundamentally a warrior, but I still thought, because of the real affection he has for Paul and vice versa, that maybe we would get some of that lighter touch, but we really don't. And so the movie becomes pretty bleak. Still watching it as a viewer, seeing Getty Prime, seeing those choices that Villeneuve makes in terms of that monochrome world, and then going so far as to have the touches where when there's a celebration and we get fireworks in this world.
Yeah.
What are the fireworks? The fireworks are these ink blots splattering the sky. I did love every bit of that. So I want to hear, it sounds like you saw that similarly or similarly enjoyed that world, despite the fact that it seems utterly devoid of joy. We enjoyed it sitting as a viewer in our theater seat. And then I also want to hear from you, Josh, next in terms of the new characters who were introduced. I mentioned Butler. You listed him in your setup. Was there someone that stood out as far as being a real star, someone you were grateful added their talents to this film? Did anyone disappoint?
Yeah, good question. As far as Getty Prime, that sequence goes, it is interesting to think about how it might hit us if it had been separated and delivered in installments, rather than this long chunk where we're introduced to Butler's character and spend a time with him. Mm-hmm. It does make that monochromatic world sink in more and feel heavier. I think that's what you're describing. And there is a benefit to that, but it does feel a little disjointed in the balance of the overall narrative. I would agree with that. But the visual, the way it's visualized, is on par with everything else I described in terms of Arrakis, but obviously a completely different palette and scheme. And it's also tied to, you know, that idea of water I hinted at. For me, introducing water so much into this, and it happens very early on in that first action sequence where the Fremen try to drain the water from the bodies of the Harkonnen soldiers. And don't they say something like, it's too polluted to use?
Yeah.
They
still do it. They get some use out of it, but they basically can't do everything they might do with it because of the pollutants.
Because it's polluted. And it's just the first instance that water throughout this movie, we're introduced to this sacred pool that the Fremen have, where the water, when a compatriot of theirs dies, they take the water out of the body and put it into this pool, and they won't drink it. They won't reuse it because it's sacred. So water throughout here is, you know, it represents the power of life, whereas the Harkonnens, and this is their drained and lifeless black and white planet, is visually suggesting this, is representing the power of death. It is absolutely destitute, drained. There is no, you know, watery life to be found there. And so that just ties in with one of the things I appreciate about the Getty Prime sequence. As far as new characters, great question. It's kind of fun that so many are introduced, even though it brings in narrative complications and motivational complications. But when you look at that cast too, the names they've managed to get, I thought Butler was pretty incredible. And we're both huge fans of him as Elvis. And so we were maybe going in, you know, kind of rooting for him. But this, I don't want to call it campy, because in my mind, I always think of camp as something that is unintentionally comedic. And I know there are debates about what camp exactly means. That's what I think of camp. So I think Butler's in complete control of everything he is doing here. Yet by bringing that Elvis charisma to it, he's like this nightclub Nosferatu, he has a ton of charm, and yet he's very scary and very threatening.
Right.
And yet he's making a choice, like the Baron, let me see if I have this right, I believe uncle, right?
Yes.
Played by Stellan Skarsgård. Butler also decides, you know what else I'm going to throw in here? Not only a little Elvis, but a little Stellan Skarsgård in my vocalization. And so that's the kind of, it worked for me. It is the kind of choice someone I could easily see someone being like, okay, all right, back up a little bit. You're just the villain here. You don't need to be putting so much into it. But a character,
he doesn't just do anything, though.
I think that's it. And you know, I think you have to go this outre. You have to really make this character register. So for me, I enjoyed what Butler was bringing here, even though he was incredibly creepy. I don't think there's anything wrong with the performance, but I think Florence Pugh gets caught up a little bit in the narrative complications / character motivations / screen time trap that expanding things this widely are just inescapably going to have. You know, playing the daughter of the Emperor, played by Christopher Walken, I'm still at a loss, Adam. You know, why did the Emperor, who's behind all this, like, you know, kick the Harkonnen out to bring the Atreides in, only to have the Harkonnen come back? And is Florence Pugh, in her opening voiceover, seems skeptical about this? Then later she's on board, and what's her role in this? She's in connection with the Bene Gesserit. Don't even get me started on the Bene Gesserit. I mean, I hope they know what they're doing, because on screen they don't seem to know what they're doing, yet they seem to be in charge of everything. And so that's been a frustrating narrative thread too. My high school daughter saw it over the weekend, and we had to go out to the suburbs this afternoon, so we had a long ride. I think we spent the majority of the time like, so is this what the Bene Gesserit watch? But then why did they do this? And does Florence Pugh like her father? And is she? And I think these are legitimate questions.
Yeah, they are. Though I think some of them are also legitimate questions that the movie does want to pose and have us wrestle with and hasn't tried to answer just yet in some cases. Now, Florence Pugh, here's my snarky line, Josh, I thought of earlier today. Was she somehow watching the last third of Dune Part 2 while she was giving this performance? Because she seems like she's really bored. Mm. She is absolutely, and this is an actress we both really appreciate, and she seems like she is sleepwalking through this performance.
It's a little aloof.
I say that, I think about Lynch's Dune and the sleepwalkers and what he does with dreams in that film. I kind of wish there was a little more of that here, as I did with Part 1 as well. But she just, aloof is a very charitable way to put it. There is nothing about her character that draws you to her and wants to know what she's thinking, what she's planning. Some of those questions that you're saying the movie wants to pose, I need her, even with her fairly limited screen time, to show me those machinations. And it's not there. Now, I know she's going to end up being a huge part of Part 3. That's obvious. But here, it doesn't completely work. And then you've got Butler, who I'm with you. I think he's very good. I think he is incredibly charismatic and scary every time he's on screen. Nightclub Nosferatu is the name of my next band. Thank you, Josh.
You got
for that. I think he's very good. And the Elvis part, I do have to say, there was something about watching him be introduced. And it is a case, and this is a common Hollywood trick, where you spend a lot of time building someone up before we actually get to glimpse them. And so then we're very intrigued. We really want to know who this person is, how they look, how they act, etc.
Nobody's done it better than Indiana Jones.
Right. They've built him up a little bit, and then we know we're going to get him. And the thing is, something about Butler's career so far, this is one of those external things I think as viewers you can't help but bring into the movie a little bit, is because of the depths he went to with Elvis and that performance, you're aware that the person they're talking about almost certainly is the guy played by Austin Butler. And so there's this mythology even built up, not just around Fade Rotha, but around the man playing him.
Sure, sure.
And so I want to see, almost in this mythical way, I want to see who this character is and what Butler is going to do with the performance. And he didn't disappoint. But I think you touched on this earlier. When we're talking about the balance of narrative here and some of these threads that are being introduced and things that maybe are being tied together too quickly, your specific point was about spending so much time on Getty Prime. Well, the reason we have to spend so much time on Getty Prime is that we have to see narratively that he is a rival. True rival in so many ways, not just in terms of what the Bene Gesserit are trying to do or what any other characters politically are trying to do, but just in terms of that hero's journey, we have to see him as the villain who is going to at some point square off against our hero, Paul. There has to be buildup there. I don't want to spoil anything, so I'm simply going to say, for us to spend as much time as we do getting that buildup and being introduced to him and getting to know him to whatever extent we can know a character like that, who is at one point referred to as a psychopath and a sociopath, I think, two different times, we don't get enough. We don't ultimately get enough of that character for the time that the movie takes to make us care about that rivalry. I'll stop it there. I don't want to dance around it too much more, but I felt like that's where that balance was really off. I understood why we needed to have that time, but then having spent that time, I wanted that rivalry to be a little more powerful and a little juicier than it ends up being.
I can see that. And I'm dancing around some spoilers here too, because for me, I think it all depends on what we think of Paul by the time the rivalry comes to the fore towards the end of the film. And I think it's very much tied into our complicated feelings about Paul as you refer to him as a hero. And that is certainly true.
Sure. Yeah. In
but
a conventional
getting chipped away, you know, the further we get into Dune Part Two, which is one of the things I liked about it. You know, one of my concerns about the first part is, you know, not having read the books is like, are we really going to get a white savior narrative here? Or is there something more complicated going on? And, you know, sure enough, we heard from listeners who have read the books and said, yeah, it's more complicated. And that's definitely the case in Dune Part Two, which I appreciated, but it's related to this rivalry. And then we almost need this figure of pure malice and evil. It doesn't take a ton of shading for us to, you know, we just have to root against him when Paul is in this confrontation, despite our conflicted feelings about Paul, which is kind of getting to me. I want to ask you a spoilerish question related to your good point. I think it's smart to delineate between the information we don't have in Dune Part Two, because the movie is purposefully holding it back because it's a middle installment, and where there are things we should know and have a better understanding of to be invested in what's occurring right now. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, Florence Pugh's character and her aloofness, that is probably going to be answered the next film. But there are things particularly related to two of the main characters that were not made clear to me, and I felt reduced my enjoyment of that last, you know, third of the film. Can I ask you here as a spoiler question, should we do this later towards the end of the show?
Yeah. Let's save it. We've been doing that. Let's save it. I'm happy to get into it too, because even though I don't know what you're going to ask me, I feel maybe a little naively, I feel like I have a pretty good handle on Paul's character by the end of the film. So
okay,
maybe I can help, or maybe I'm completely misguided. Josh, in terms of last minute things or final thoughts on this film before we get into any spoiler talk at the end, as much as we're praising the spectacle here and it's completely justified, I was thinking about you a little bit during a key sequence in this film. You knew the sandworms were going to come up.
Oh yeah. We got to talk sandworms.
It's the desert Arrakis form of Uber. Apparently you could just call one and you wait by the block and it shows up and everyone gets on and
do you get a nice ride. You know what they're trying now? Like $5 more for it to come 2 minutes sooner. Do you think the worms do that?
I'm guessing we'll see.
Total scam,
three,
by the way,
Josh, but you talk about, and you're right to do so, you lament sometimes how directors in big budget sci-fi movies, or not even sci-fi, but just movies where you've got these big action sequences, do they cheat? Do they cheat by making them at nighttime? Do they make them at nighttime and they add rain or whatever it is, so that can obscure some of the finer details of it? There's this huge sequence involving Paul and the sandworm, and we spend like 12 minutes inside a sandstorm. And I found it utterly unthrilling and a cheat.
Yeah, I totally get that. And it fits that test of, are you going to try to blur what's going on in the background to get away with stuff? I actually liked that choice because, first of all, I think we're in Hulk territory here. I don't think movie technology has yet advanced to give us a decent Hulk.
I do think that's fair. I don't know how you do this.
I don't think movie technology has advanced to the point to give us consistently a good Dune sandworm. That said, I think the choice they made around that in that sequence of Paul riding the sandworm works because it keeps us close to him and his overwhelmed but persistent experience. So I would almost rather have that feeling, like I got some taste of the chaos it would be to be riding some massive beast that is plunging in and out of dunes and hanging on for dear life, than a pristine long shot where you're like, oh yeah, that guy way off in the distance, he looks believable. Like that looks believable. There was something about the immersiveness, But your point is well taken. It does mean a lot of brown stuff swirling around and very few long shots. Mm-hmm. The worm buses, worm Uber, worm Uber, as you put it.
It's worm Uber.
Worm Uber, maybe not quite as effective.
No.
And I'll just leave it at that. And then, but I am going to say, when they are using the worms to attack in the climactic big battle scene, pretty awesome. And that's in the light of day. Again, 10-year-old me. Oh man. Oh, if only little Josh had been able to see this.
I didn't say this during our Dune 1 revisit, but I know we're also both big fans of Dave Bautista generally as an actor, and he doesn't get enough to do.
No, he gets the raw end in this.
As I think Glossu is his name. I had to look that up. I don't know if he's ever given a name here. Maybe the Harkonnen don't, you know, they don't really refer to each other by name much. We do hear Fade Rotha a fair amount, but Glossu's the family member who gets ignored. He doesn't get enough to do in either film. I still love every time he's on screen and the choice he makes to play Glossu as this chronic mouth breather. Like he's so dumb. He just has that stare and that mouth wide open, and something about it, Josh, I actually think is really effective.
I mean, I like to think Bautista is knowing, like I know and have shown on screen how much more I'm capable of. I'm just going to go full on mouth breather to kind of point out that I'm better than this, because
maybe
it is a completely thankless part. Really quick, you mentioned the humorlessness of this, and I actually think this is a funnier installment. I think that's all about Javier Bardem. We have not mentioned him
yet.
He's
great.
He gets a much bigger part. He's the zealot Fremen who believes in this prophecy and that Paul is this Messiah. And at the same time, I think about bringing humor to that sort of part, right? Because he's incredibly serious. And then this devout Fremen, but he also has a little bit of lightness to his line readings, to certain moments that made me realize, oh, there's actually a little bit of humor in this one that I appreciated.
Yeah, I think that's part of why I enjoyed that first half so much is he's such a central figure, and the questions about faith that this movie wants us to wrestle with, and I mean that really in the context of seeing Paul as this Messiah or not, but it raises larger questions about belief in general and what kind of signs and evidence.
Fundamentalism.
And fundamentalism, just what's the function of religion and spirituality generally. All of that's there, and it's all there because of Javier Bardem's character and that performance and us seeing it all unfold through his eyes and his beliefs. That's the human drama, that element that I did really appreciate there. Also because it's tied to feelings he clearly has for Paul. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's as if they're best buddies. It's important to him, to Stilgarth, that character, that Paul is who he believes Paul to be more than anything. But there's enough of that friendship and kinship and respect there that makes it matter. Now let's go back and I'll end where I began with Rebecca Ferguson, who here again is a wonderful actress giving a really good overall performance. But after
This is the spoiler.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, let's save this.
Here, all I'll say by way of non-spoilers is the movie doesn't give her enough depth. I think the movie hands her a certain role, and that character has to play it, and that humanity that I wanted to see, I didn't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have a question about why that might be that I'm hoping you can answer.
Okay. I look forward to that Dune Part 2 spoiler talk at the end of the show. If you have seen Dune Part 2 and you agree or disagree with our thoughts, we would like to hear from you. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Coming up, 50s Madness Round 2. But first, we want to talk about a couple of very easy ways you can help the show, whether you're a longtime listener or just finding us. Would you mind taking a minute and giving us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify? When you're an independently produced show like ours, every new rating or review does help us reach new listeners. So thank you very much to Atlanta Movie Nerd, who wrote, "Highly recommended for any movie lover. 5 stars. I started listening in 2020 while quarantining and was completely new to movie criticism. The first episodes I listened to were part one and part two of the top 10 movies of 2019. What a great year for movies. I love the in-depth and thoughtful conversation around each movie, and I've been hooked ever since. Thank you, Adam, Josh, and Sam, for taking movies seriously but never taking yourselves too seriously. I've learned a lot from you." Thank you, Atlanta Movie Nerd. Another way you can support us, you can join the Film Spotting family over at filmspottingfamily.com. We want to welcome a new member, and that's Rebecca Lamert in Virginia. I hope I've got that right. Rebecca, your name. She writes, "I was already a cinephile when I arrived at college, but when I started dating a film major, the obsession only intensified, and I started searching for film podcasts to beef up my knowledge and awareness, as well as our conversations together. I found Film Spotting and have been listening for about 10 years now."
We're your dating companion. We're here for all of you out there who need to try to impress a new partner.
The cinematic third wheel.
Yeah. Rebecca continues, "The Coen brothers are my favorite filmmakers. Great choice, great taste there, Rebecca. I feel like they have mastered the difficult to achieve tone that balances darkness, humor, and genuine enlightenment all at once without collapsing under all of that weight. I love every review that deals with their work and sought out all of the archive episodes related to them. I think Josh and Adam appreciate the Coens the same way I do." Rebecca does say, but, and don't worry, Josh, this is going to come around. This is going to come around Team Josh in a major way.
Okay.
"I think Josh is too lenient, way too lenient on Marvel films, especially the most recent ones. However, I appreciate his generous nature overall. To quote another favorite podcast, We Hate Movies, it's okay to like a movie." Her current Letterboxd, that's ironic, by the way, but I get it. Rebecca's Letterboxd 4 favorites. "I try to use my top 4 to represent the wide variety of genres that I like. Currently, I have The Exorcist, the 73 original. Believer was abysmal. Master and Commander, yes. Calvary and Rear Window."
There it
I've
is.
"I've also probably seen," yeah, you've got Rear Window. I get The Exorcist in there. "I've also probably seen the Lord of the Rings trilogy about 100 times, but that would take up 3 of the 4 slots. A random film or filmmaker Rebecca loves. My husband and I watch Bull Durham several times a year. Our relationship is built on a love of baseball, and Bull Durham is perfect. He also very generously puts up with my obsession with 80s Kevin Costner."
Good
credits
man.
"Pulp Fiction." Yeah, I'm with you. "Credits Pulp Fiction with becoming a cinephile, and finally a favorite book about films or filmmaking, appropriately. Rebecca says, I recently finished reading Quentin Tarantino's Cinema Speculation and loved it, but I've read Josh's Movies Are Prayers and Fear Not multiple times and made several recommendations. Fear Not is a book I had needed for years before it was published. Josh, not your book, you are a gift."
Wow, Rebecca. Oh, and now I feel triply terrible if I mispronounced your last name, but thank you so much.
Yeah, this is great work by Debbie sending this in, Josh. Thank you, Rebecca, and welcome to the family. In addition to keeping us doing what we're doing, your support comes with perks. You get to listen early and ad-free. You get our weekly newsletter. You get a monthly bonus show. You also get complete archive access. Like Rebecca, go back and check out those Coen Brothers conversations. The monthly bonus show this week, and that exclusive opportunity for our family members is to participate in trivia spotting. We're only a little over a week away as we sit here. Josh, it's been a very long time since we last played trivia, and the family members turned out. I don't know how we're going to fit everybody into the Zoom. We have so many people trying to cram into trivia spotting. It's going to be great.
And do you think we've improved in our trivia skills since this long hiatus, or just lost more memory brain cells in the time?
You know it's the latter. You know it's the latter. Filmspottingfamily.com is where you can get more information and join and support the show.
Hi.
I'm sorry?
I just said hi.
Hi, hello. Hi.
Okay, if I sit closer? How far are you going?
Rockville Center.
Get out. Me too.
Really?
What are the odds? Do I know you?
Josh, it's somehow been 20 years since Joel and Clementine's fateful meeting on that train to Montauk, which means it's as good a time as any for us to take another look at, yes, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. In our case, we didn't need Lacuna's help to forget most of the details. It's been quite a while since I've seen Eternal Sunshine, a movie I'm pretty sure I didn't see in the theater, saw it on home video, and then I revisited it in 2010 as we were preparing for Film Spotting's top 20 films of the decade. We were looking back at the decade for Film Spotting's 300th episode then. This is before you joined the show, Josh. I knew I needed to see it if I was truly going to consider it for my top 20. It did end up making my top 20. And shortly after that, it was later in August 2010 that it went into the Film Spotting Pantheon. So it's one of those films that's in the Pantheon. It's been talked about here and there on the show, but we've never given it a full review, a full conversation. And we're embarking on this Pantheon project that is kind of an unofficial Pantheon project because we've never followed through on exactly what we're trying to accomplish.
Let's just say the Bene Gesserit are in charge.
I think they are in charge, but
that would explain a lot.
What we're really just trying to do, that would explain some of Sam's choices, actually, some of his diabolical choices.
We'll never get to the bottom of it.
He's always been the person pulling the strings. Yep. He's pulling the strings behind it all.
But does he know why?
Maybe not. One of the things he wants us to really do here is, hey, if a movie is in the Pantheon, maybe we should talk about it before it, I guess, stays there. So Eternal Sunshine is on the docket, 20-year anniversary. It should be a good conversation. Again, it's been 14 years, roughly, since I saw it last. What about you?
Yeah, this was my number one film the year it came out. It's in the archives over there at the Naperville Sun. And Adam, I don't think I've seen it since that year for whatever reason. Maybe I'm wrong. This is way before the days of Letterboxd. I can't check, but it has been a while. And I think it's particularly smart to revisit this one because Eternal Sunshine, more than any other film in the Pantheon, probably, I think we've failed to discuss at all because of the rules we've long had where these films are not eligible for top five lists. And we fudge that here and there for Sacred Cows or, you know, certain top fives. I don't think we've ever fudged it in any way for Eternal Sunshine, the Spotless Mind. It does seem to me like this great movie, as I remember it, that has kind of been lost in a film spotting black hole. And now we get to rectify that.
Yeah. Speaking of details that I know I didn't remember, I wonder if you remember where Eternal Sunshine finished back in 2019 when we did our best films of the 2000s for Madness. Do you remember how high it placed?
I would think it would do fairly well, but maybe not top four.
It was second.
Oh, no, I did not remember that.
Eternal Sunshine beat out titles like, and this is just going to prove later, this is foreshadowing, it's going to prove the fallibility of our listeners. It beat out titles like No Country for Old Men, Mulholland Drive, The Dark Knight, Fellowship of the Ring, and more.
Oh, man. Would never have guessed that.
Yeah.
Which is
completely blanked.
I'm apparently doing poorly in this year's Madness.
Along with that 20th anniversary Sacred Cow conversation about Eternal Sunshine, we will have 50s Madness round two results and Sweet 16 matchups. And the first film in our William Wyler, our long-awaited, long-anticipated William Wyler marathon. We are starting back in the 30s with 1936's Dodsworth. And I say long-awaited and anticipated because this is a filmmaker who has been on our short list of subjects for at least 10 or 15 years. And you get it. He's the most nominated director in Oscar history. Throughout that fact last week with Michael Phillips here, 12 nominations, 3 wins. He also happens to be the director of one of my most conspicuous movie, Blind Spots, The Best Years of Our Lives from 1946. You've seen it. We will talk about that film here in the next month or so as part of this marathons. But Josh, a little background. These marathons, we usually do 2 of them a year. They go all the way back to the very beginning of the show, 2005. 2006, where we're trying to fill in cinematic blind spots. And we've both seen some Wyler films, some as part of other marathons here on the show. But he is definitely a filmmaker who has some major titles that we've long been a little bit embarrassed about not seeing. And in the case of Wyler, not only is he that decorated when it comes to Oscar nominations, but he's a major figure undeniably in the golden age of Hollywood, a career spanning six decades. And I mentioned The Best Years of Our Lives. Ben-Hur is another one. Speaking of the 50s, Ben-Hur is another classic film I haven't seen. And both of those films were Best Picture winners and did win Wyler the Best Director Oscar. So with Wyler, there should be a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I'm excited about is that span, that six decade timeline you talked about, is to just look not only at how his style may have evolved, but the different concerns cinema was even addressing, and think about from one decade to the next. We don't always get this expansive time over the course of a marathon. And that's one of the reasons I think we're starting back in the 30s with 1936's Dodsworth. That's going to be next week. And that was where Wyler earned his first Best Director nomination. From there, we'll go to Mrs. Miniver. That's the first of Wyler's combined Best Director, Best Picture wins, and then Best Years of Our Lives, which, as you mentioned, I have seen, and it was one of those, I can vividly remember watching it on my laptop on a business trip in a hotel room. One of those, you know, you get back from whatever you had to do a little early, and so it's just like, let me watch a movie I've always meant to watch. And yeah, I don't know why I chose it. Seemed like one of those, I had no idea what I was getting into, how good The Best Years of Our Lives turned out to be, despite Wyler's reputation. And so I'm hoping that's the case with just about all the titles in this marathon.
Yeah, we've got six films, as usual, in this marathon. You can view the full lineup and see some options as far as where you can view these films. All are available VOD on various platforms over at filmspotting.net. Just click on marathons right there at the top of the page. And we don't have the details to announce yet, and we will definitely give you plenty of warning. But I feel safe enough, Josh, to at least tease the fact that we should have a pretty cool event, a live event tied to one of the films that's going to make up this marathon. So again, more details about that to come.
I wanted to share a quick note, Adam, a quick weekend report. Debbie and I got away to New York City over the weekend to visit our daughter, who's finishing up college. Can't believe this, but she'll be done in the spring. And so we thought, let's go visit her, take the roommates out. We hadn't done this yet. And plan this around the Athena Film Festival that takes place every year at her college. Always meant to go, never got around to it. We're like, we're making it happen this year. So these are movies, you know, primarily telling stories, focusing on women, largely almost entirely female directed. And I wanted to highlight one we saw because it just got picked up for distribution by Apple Original Films, and it's Fancy Dance. And I want to just put this on listeners' radar because it's good. It's quite good and interesting. But also the story that was shared after the film on this panel about the long journey for Fancy Dance to get distribution. So there were a handful of people on the panel. It was about indigenous filmmakers in the United States. And the director of Fancy Dance, Erica Tremblay, was a member of the panel. And she talked about how this movie was well received at Sundance in 2023. And well-reviewed audience responses and so forth. It had been worked on. I'm not sure if it was a Sundance workshop, but it had gone through. The way she put it is, we had hit every checklist you hit for a small independent movie to get some sort of distribution deal, and it didn't happen. Lily Gladstone is the star, I should point out here, which makes this also curious. She plays a Native American woman who is a bit of a hustler. She kind of lives on the edge of the law. And when we meet her, her sister has disappeared. So she's undergoing this search for her sister, spends a lot of time with her sister's teen daughter, caring for her at this time. And so you would think, Erica Tremblay was also saying, having Lily Gladstone, who all the buzz coming up with Killers of the Flower Moon, beyond what she'd already gotten among, you know, real cinephile circles for certain women and so forth, that they would have landed that deal. And it just didn't happen for whatever reason. And so she was saying how they just spent last year going to every festival they could, keeping knocking on doors, and finally, with the help of Gladstone getting her Oscar nomination and talking about Fancy Dance. I haven't noticed this because I haven't been watching a lot of the award circuit speeches and stuff. Talking about Fancy Dance almost every time she could, it kind of brought this back to the top and eventually led to a conversation with Apple, who, as most people know, has Killers of the Flower Moon. And they realized, well, this is a natural pairing. to have on our service for folks who watch Killers and then might be interested in this. And that's absolutely true. It's a piercing contemporary companion piece. Not only Gladstone, not only the fact of Native American characters, but this exact story of Native American women who go missing and no one cares. But to see that told through a slightly different lens in a slightly different time frame, but also yet see the similarities is just one of the fascinating things about the film beyond, obviously, Gladstone's performance. So I'm hoping maybe we can give this a little more time. If I revisit it, we get a chance to see it. I don't know the release date, but when that comes, because this is definitely one worthy of consideration for Golden Brick. But for now, just wanted to get that out there. Keep your eyes open. And if you have an opportunity to watch Fancy Dance, give it a shot.
I'll definitely keep an eye out. And as you said, we'll keep an eye out for our listeners, let you know when we have more information about that release. Over on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, they have a new pairing that should appeal to our new family member, Rebecca, we mentioned a bit earlier. Ethan Coen's Driveaway Dolls with Raising Arizona, just one of the best movie comedies ever made. That's The Next Picture Show every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This is madness.
Madness.
Madness, madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
Yes, Film Spotting Madness time, our annual bracket-style tournament. This year, it's devoted to the best films of the 1950s. That means Hitchcock, Kurosawa, Wilder, Bergman, so many other big names in cinema. 64 films go in, but only one champion can emerge. We've got our round one results, and we'll highlight some round two matchups for you. Round two voting is live. It closes Monday, March 11th at noon Central Time. If you want to vote, we encourage you to do so. Go to filmspotting.net, or you can go right to the page at filmspotting.net/madness. First round results, Josh, only two upsets, at least according to the seeding, which Sam and I, as the selection committee, sometimes like to take that to mean that we did a good job with our seeding. Yeah. If there weren't a bunch of upsets, it's really hard to call the upsets upsets as well, because one of them was Ben-Hur, 36th seed overall, beating number 29, A Man Escaped, the Bresson film. And number 38, Anatomy of a Murder, besting, oh, it hurts so bad. I mean, like, life wasn't cruel to Cabiria enough in the film, in Fellini's masterpiece. Knights of Cabiria out, losing to Otto Preminger's film. So our favorite film from the Bresson Marathon is gone, and one of my favorite, Fellini's, one of my all-time favorite foreign language films is gone. It is a case where you've got two star-driven Hollywood films taking out foreign films, and in both cases as well, you have matchups that I incorrectly predicted. I went with the cinephile taste, what I thought was the cinephile taste. Art House Adam saw these movies through his lens and assumed that our audience would as well. But Josh, Ben-Hur, Anatomy of a Murder, Hollywood won out. Hollywood triumphed.
I think those two got me as well. So credence to the selection committee, I guess, on that.
S.J. Lucero says, I just rewatched A Man Escaped and Ben-Hur, and the Bresson would be a sight and sound top 10 choice for me. Ben-Hur has an absolute banger of a chariot race and 2 hours and 30 minutes of other stuff.
Well, let's hope we appreciate some of that other stuff when we get to it in our Weiler Marathon. Here's Richard. This matchup between Knights of Cabiria and Anatomy of a Murder killed me right out of the gate. I love both movies and am currently on a Fellini deep dive. While both are on my top four on Letterboxd, I have to go with Anatomy since it takes place in the town where I was born, Marquette, Michigan. As good a reason as any, I guess.
Neither of those was our closest matchup, though. This one came right down to it, Josh. It came down to the buzzer at 12 noon today as we're recording. And speaking of good jobs by the selection committee, number 32 versus 33, Douglas Sirk's Imitation of Life versus Disney's Sleeping Beauty. And in the end, Sirk took down Disney by four votes.
Don't tell me your vote doesn't matter. Don't tell me
that's
that.
Right. I have a feeling, Sam Thompson says, I may be discounting how people feel about Sleeping Beauty, but to me, it can't compete with Cirque's most delicious melodrama.
Here's W. David Lichty. Sleeping Beauty is a stone-cold masterpiece, one of Disney's most artful movies.
Yeah, and it seems Stuhl at the end agrees, I demand a recount.
Oh boy.
Stuhl says.
Here we go.
Let's not get into that. Other films we had to say goodbye to. Not only did we lose Knights of Cabiria, we lost Fellini's La Strada. We lost Bresson's A Man Escaped and Pickpocket. Bresson is gone, out of the best of the 50s.
Ouch.
We did lose one Hitchcock, Dial M for Murder. Tough to blame anyone for this, Josh. It got beat out by Ozu's Tokyo Story. And don't worry, there are still four Hitchcocks left in the tournament. Your Tati, Mon Uncle, in a losing battle up against, well, who but number two seed Singing in the Rain?
Yeah, I mean, sad, but completely understandable.
Now, this one I had hopes for. I was naively optimistic that in the battle against a Kubrick film, not Paths of Glory in this tournament, but The Killing, that Carl Theodore Dreyer's Ordet, one of my top four on Letterboxd, of course Ordet would triumph. But no, it lost The Killing.
The power of Kubrick is strong, and I also predicted this wrongly.
Yeah.
I just got to stop listening to you, clearly. That's what's the problem here.
Hey, in terms of predicting the bracket, I picked The Killing. I knew The Killing was going to win.
Oh,
I just hoped. I just hoped it wouldn't. Some other titles that are gone. How about these? Wilder's Ace in the Hole, Sweet Smell of Success, An American in Paris, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Diabolique, Hiroshima Mon Amour, Earrings of Madame De from Ophuls, and Jules Dassin's Rififi. Though Rififi did put up a good fight in its matchup against High Noon. Thousands of votes cast. Rififi lost by 25.
One person who did vote for Rififi, Jonathan Anderson. My apologies to Grinnell's own Carrie Cooper, but go Rififi, go.
Thank you, Jonathan, for that. And here's David Lichty again. Will win High Noon. Should. Honestly, two-thirds of Rififi is just a decent heist picture, bested by all of High Noon, but that other third of Rififi is strong enough to carry the whole film over the line. Watching the old DVD, my friends and I were breathless, silent, like exhaling would blow their cover.
Yes.
Have you seen Rififi, Josh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a perfect description of it. That's exactly how you feel watching that movie. Now, I don't know that I think the first two-thirds is just decent, but this is the movie that created the template that every heist film after has tried to follow and has had to emulate. And it's why I picked Rififi over High Noon, but listeners did not High Noon advance. So that brings us to round two, 32 films, 16 matchups. I thought we'd go ahead and approach this similar to last week. I've got some upsets I'm rooting for. I've got some toughest to pick. We'll see if there were any that were tough to predict, like there was with round one. I have to confess to one matchup here, Josh, that I am abstaining. Only one, but it's that Ben-Hur matchup. Vertigo versus Ben-Hur, even though, of course, I'm inclined to click that button for Vertigo because it's Vertigo. Technically, I'm holding out. I didn't do Wyler justice here in Film Spotting Madness. I'm going to hold off and watch Ben-Hur as we get into the marathon. So, no vote for me. I am abstaining there. Upsets I'm rooting for. I'm curious if you've got any. I've got three. The Night of the Hunter is an underdog to Hitchcock's North by Northwest. I think it's got a very good chance, and I'm definitely pulling for it. I adore All About Eve. Who doesn't love All About Eve? But it's going against one of my formative foreign language films, an all-timer, a masterpiece from Ingmar Bergman. Yeah, it could be The Seventh Seal, but it's Wild Strawberries. Both are in the tournament. And here's my one heretical pick. People are going to gasp. Just listen for the gasps from Film Spotting Nation when I say this. I'm going to lose credibility instantly with so many people when I say this. But in the matchup of one of the top four seeds, The Seven Samurai, over Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, I'm pulling for Strangers on a Train.
Yeah, you know, this is where, like, sometimes I feel like you have a bulletproof suit. We did a Seven Samurai bonus show once.
I know.
And you were like,
I got five Kurosawas that I think are better than six.
And I'm like, I said, oh man, this poor guy. Like, if I said that, there would be a government inquiry.
I was so eloquent there were about crickets. how I articulated it.
I apparently you're okay. Apparently no one's gonna gasp at that one.
I think they are.
I think, you know, Night of the Hunter to go against Hitchcock seems heretical as well. But I'm not going to be shocked, and this is how I would vote, actually, if Hunter does take North by Northwest out. I feel like North by Northwest is a fun movie that a lot of people like, but there is a ton of deep passion for the astonishing artistry of Night of the Hunter that I'm always surprised. Let me just say, here's the weird feeling is when I encounter someone online, wherever it might be, Letterboxd or whatever, who just goes on and out Night of the Hunter, I have that feeling of, oh, you too? You know, there's a little bit where I wouldn't if someone's like, yeah, I think North by Northwest is really great. It's like, yeah, we all pretty much like North by Northwest. But there's that deep abiding appreciation for Night of the Hunter. So we'll see what happens there.
Next category, toughest to pick. And this is pretty easy to determine. The criterion is, did I hesitate? When I went through the polls, was I able to just click the button and I knew exactly which one I wanted to win? Or did I have to stall? And there's three here, Josh. And the first one, not only did I stall, not only did I hesitate, I am at this point still refusing to vote. I've been facing this because it was pretty decisive that these two were going to face each other. The round one battles weren't very close. I've had time to think about this, and I still do not know which one I'm going to vote for. Two films that couldn't be in some ways more different. One is a war movie. One is about a bureaucrat. And yet they are both properly regarded as two of the most humanist films ever made. Kubrick's Paths of Glory and Kurosawa's Ikiru. I don't know how to pick. I don't know. I'm not going to on this show. I don't know if I ever will. I might have to abstain from this one as well. I say down with the selection committee.
Yeah, Ikiru, clearly, you know, way better than Seven Samurai. We know that in your world, right?
in my estimation, yes, I do like it okay. better. Just slightly, but I prefer it.
I would say my struggle looking over these matchups like that would be between Some Like It Hot and High Noon. And I think we're both stumbling around on the same thing. It's hard to get your minds around movies that are of completely different genres or tackling completely different things. This was the Sleeping Beauty Imitation of Life quandary, right? I think that is one of the reasons that came down to the wires. How do you pair those two together? So how do you pair one of the great comedies with one of the great Westerns? Yeah, that's the one I will probably make my choice last. So I'm certainly not going to say where I'm going right now.
I mentioned I had three. I did hesitate for a bit, and then I ultimately chose The Searchers over Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. But I do love that Orson Welles film. And I actually had in here the one you just mentioned, Some Like It Hot versus High Noon. And it's a little bit of a different case for me. I haven't done this exercise, but if I ranked these films from 1 to 32, going from most favorite to least favorite, and I just want everyone to keep in mind so I can try to forego any more gasps here, Josh. We are talking about 32 of the best films ever from a decade that's one of the best ever. But High Noon and Some Like It Hot would both be probably in the bottom six somewhere of that 32. That's how much I love the other 26 films that are in round two of Film Spotting Madness. One of those movies that would definitely be ahead of High Noon, though, is Some Like It Hot. And it is my choice here, even though I did hesitate a little. In terms of toughest to predict, here's famous last words. We'll see if I do any better with my round two predictions, but I didn't have any that I felt were tough to predict. That doesn't mean I'll be right. I'm sure I'll lose something. The listeners are going to surprise me, but nothing felt like it was incredibly shocking to guess which film would emerge on top. Again, we'll see if I'm wrong, but I didn't really have any where, while I was filling out my bracket, I thought, oh gosh, I just don't know where the listeners are going to go. Had a few of those with round one. I didn't this time. Did you?
Well, my bracket is a little shaken up now, but, but yeah, when I initially went to make predictions, looking at the ones that, you know, haven't gotten shaken up, I would say it was pretty easy this round. I do wonder about the Kubrick power. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, seeing Ikuru up against it, you would think it's got to be Ikuru. But again, underestimating Kubrick has bitten me before. Can I just take a moment and bid adieu to my beloved Padre Panchali in advance? This is, you know...
Yeah, into a film you didn't want to see it lose to.
One of the greatest to ever have been projected on a screen that is going to lose. Let's just say I'm going to be a very angry man, Adam.
Josh
angry man.
You're going to be one of those angry men. He's so disappointed in all of you because I do think you're right. This is an easy choice for me. Padre Panchali over 12 Angry Men. But 12 Angry Men is definitely going to move on to the Sweet 16, isn't it?
Please, when it happens, shove the camera right in my face and turn up my mic to hot.
Okay.
So that everyone understands what I'm saying.
How dare you? Some that were easy to choose for me. Again, we're talking about 32 great films. I love Bridge on the River Kwai. I love Rio Bravo a lot more. I like Kubrick a lot. I love Kubrick, in fact, but Singing in the Rain over The Killing is a no-brainer. The 400 Blows over Rebel Without a Cause is a no-brainer. I'll give you one more that was a little tough. I actually did hesitate over this one just slightly. It's another Kurosawa, Rashomon and On the Waterfront. It's tough to lose that Kazan film and lose Brando. I know Sam, producer Sam, is struggling with the Brandos in particular because I think Tokyo Story is going to take down Streetcar, and I'm totally fine with that. And I did ultimately pick Rashomon over On the Waterfront, but to have both of those just monumental Marlon Brando performances just be gone here in round two of 50s Madness seems, I don't know, not quite right.
Well, let me say this, and I will get the letters. Rashomon, not top tier. Not top tier Kurosawa.
Oh, that's not your top tier Kurosawa.
No.
Okay.
No. I think that this is an easy one, On the Waterfront, because you know there are better Kurosawas.
There are better Kurosawas. Thank you, Josh. So there are, well, better than Seven Samurai. I know where you're going. Okay. You've made your point. Before we go, I have not yet looked at any of the back-end results so far because round two is live, and I didn't want it to shade at all how I talked about these picks, but I'm going to say this. I should have put this in the toughest to predict. It turns out it was tough to predict and tough to pick. Paths of Glory in Ikiru, Josh, right now is separated by 2 votes.
Yeah. I'm telling you, it's the Kubrick.
It is the Kubrick factor. We'll see if both of them make it to the Sweet 16. But there's no way. There's no way The Killing's taking down Singing in the Rain, Josh. It's all good. It's definitely going to be there. We look forward to sharing those round two results with you next week and get into those Sweet 16 contests. After round one, there are 12 listeners out of over 500 who submitted prediction brackets and have perfect brackets.
That means,
Josh, they are tied for first
That's
place.
Crazy.
Perfect 32 out of 32. And I am beginning to think something here is just amiss. To have Brett Fisher, to have him, the Jim Boeheimlich maneuver, that was his team name a few years back. I don't know if it's the same. Actually, it turns out he's got a new one. He's the seventh seal of the samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whatever samurai tricks he's applying, whatever wisdom he's applying, it's working. He's one of those 12. Again, a former winner of this bracket challenge. Many listeners only missed a single matchup. Those include our friends Mitchell Beaupre from Letterboxd, Brett Merriman, last year's family bracket winner, and Brett's LA amigo and ours, Jason Eakin, all
what?
Only one incorrect choice. That's not us, though.
Wait a minute. We hung out with both Brett and Jason when we were in LA for the live show. Yeah. Are you sure they weren't rifling through your briefcase or Sam's or picking notebooks, well, looking at your charts and spreadsheets
maybe,
and notes? Because this is ridiculous.
It is. It is. But if they had actually done any of that, if they cheated at all, they'd be doing worse, because I got four wrong. I did think that the more popular film, what I thought was the populist choice here, I thought Sleeping Beauty would take down Imitation of Life.
It almost did.
Yeah, and it almost did. In the three other cases where I went with my heart and, again, what I thought was the cinephile conventional wisdom, I was proved wrong. A Man Escaped is out. Lestrade's out. Knights of Cabiria is out. I am tied for 221st. The good news for me is that none of those misses impacts future rounds. I'm still alive.
Nice.
I can still win, or I can still not lose, which is really winning. Josh, you missed five. You also picked Sleeping Beauty, mm-hmm. A Man Escaped, and Knights of Cabiria. You did have Ordit over Kubrick's The Killing. And I did think, when I saw your bracket, I thought, he really thinks Ace in the Hole is going to beat Bridge on the River Kwai? What was going through your head?
Good question. Again, probably probably listening to you so much.
You've talked about that. He goes, yeah,
the movie so much. And even though I watched it, made up that blind spot for this contest and liked it, but thought, yeah, it's, there are better Wilders. Let me say that. Better Wilders. I thought, amount of times Adam's been talking about this, I'm sure it'll win. And
that's what Sam said to me.
Foolishness.
He's like, sometimes Josh really puts way too much stock in your influence.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Well, let's hope that never wanes, but the River Kwai miss could end up hurting you. We'll see. Sam only missed three. Sleeping Beauty and Cabiria were among those two. And then somehow he thought listeners would choose Roman Holiday over Kurosawa's Akira. Akira did advance. Mike Merrigan, Film Spotting Madness Godfather, who won last year's contest, won it outright. Here he is again, only missing one. Sleeping Beauty.
Of course.
Josh. So he's tied for second with many others in the big bracket tournament. And again, is leading ours, this little internal competition that we have where the loser ends up having to watch whatever the latest Adam Sandler movie is on Netflix. I think.
It could be pretty dicey this year, actually, based on early returns for Spaceman.
I know. Round two voting is open. Please do participate. It's fun. It's goofy. It really does, at the very least, make you think about why you love some of these films you profess to love so much. Filmspotting.net or filmspotting.net/madness. And Josh, that's our show.
If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. If you want to vote in Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 1950s, you can do that at filmspotting.net or filmspotting.net/madness. For show t-shirts or other merch, go to filmspotting.net/shop. Film Spotting is listener supported. You can join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to the show early and ad-free. You'll also get a weekly newsletter, monthly bonus shows, and access to the entire Film Spotting archive.
In those archives, you can find our original review of Dune Part 1 from 2021, the other, the revisit from a couple of weeks ago, and you can go back to our 8 from 84 review of David Lynch's Dune, all of that at filmspottingfamily.com. Out in wide release, it's a bear weekend, Josh. Imaginary is about a young girl who develops an eerie attachment to a stuffed bear that she finds in the basement, and if that doesn't work for you, you can go see Kung Fu Panda 4.
Or double feature.
There you go. In limited release, a film that was supposed to come out last year, we didn't get to see it. I know we're both curious. Problemista from Salvadoran director Julio Torres. He directs and stars. Tilda Swinton's in it. Greta Lee, Isabella Rossellini. It's an immigration comedy. It premiered at the 2023 South by Southwest Film Fest that opens in Chicago and elsewhere this weekend. And here's another immigration story, Shada, this one about a woman fleeing Iran with her child to Australia. Our friend Isaac Feldberg writes, it's rare to see a directorial debut this emotionally moving and assured. Sounds like Golden Brick potential. Josh, that director is Nora Niasari, and it's playing at the Siskel Film Center in Chicago. Next week, it is our Pantheon Sacred Cow revisit of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It's 20 years old. That's on Peacock and elsewhere on VOD. And we are commencing our William Wyler marathon with 1936's Dodsworth.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Veronica Phillips. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
We have a little bit of unfinished business. And now that you've changed it, or at the end of our conversation, I realized that you were really talking about Lady Jessica and not so much Paul, Usul, Muad'Dib, Kwisatz, Haderach. I think I got all of his names in there. Maybe I'm going to have less to offer, Josh, less insight. I won't be able to answer your question, but we're in Dune spoiler territory. We're in the spoiler part of Arrakis. We're going to huddle together. We're going to try to figure this out. I want to know what you want to know.
So it's related to both of them. It's related to Lady Jessica and Paul, and it's related to a crucial act they both take, drinking this water of life. We could just call it worm juice. I think that's fair as well. And what I was not sure of is once they have done that, and she, I think, it was going through my mind, actually, you know, knowing your complaints, having just had our conversation, our second conversation about the first film, about Lady Jessica, you know, she's so instrumental in that opening scene. She becomes this, you know, prophetess slash witch figure. And I thought, oh man, Adam's got to be loving this. He wanted more Lady Jessica. Boy, is he getting the Lady Jessica. But then she drinks this water of life slash worm juice. And it's almost as if like she has, I don't want to say become zombified, but the question of interior choice seems to be lost.
Exactly.
And the same thing seems to happen when Paul chooses to drink the water of life. Now she does it more clearly. It's because if she doesn't, she's threatened with death. And so it's sort of a scenario where, okay, she's going to do it and see what happens. His is a little more clouded. I may not be. I saw this like 2.5 weeks ago now. I think at that point he has started to lean toward pursuing, embracing this messianic role. Maybe not because he fully believes he is the Messiah, but because he knows he can use that status to achieve revenge on the Harkonnen for murdering his countrymen and family. And so perhaps that's why he chooses to drink it. But my question is it your impression that once doing that, they do lose the faculty of, let's just call it free will? Because I think this is where some of the interesting religious questions come in as well. And what was an intriguing interrogation of the white savior trope, because it starred a figure conflicted about that and wrestling with that, now became a figure who is sort of hypnotized to be that, which to me, this was the struggle I had with the last third or whatever, is because I felt like I was watching Paul essentially doing what he, working out a spell that had been cast upon him. But am I totally misreading that?
No. I don't think you are at all. I think that's all very well said. And I think we see it the same way. And I think we agree on a lot in terms of how we responded to these storylines and these characters and what happens to them. Maybe in terms of how much we appreciated them, we differ slightly. And I'll try to explain. We, I think, are in lockstep on Lady Jessica, where that's what I was starting to get at the end of our review proper, where once she drinks the poison, as it's referred to, she drinks that water of life, it is as if she becomes possessed.
Yeah.
And while there's a part of that that I found really interesting in a sinister kind of way, I responded to it. I liked that moment where, you know, now she's talking to the to the baby inside her, and she has that monologue, but she gets to talk to this creature, so it's not just her giving a soliloquy and talking to herself. She says, and maybe she's actually not talking out loud. I can't remember the scene. She, of course, is just having this conversation, you know, in their heads. I don't think she's saying these words. What she's thinking and expressing is this notion that to advance what we need to advance, we need to start swaying followers.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to start on this path, this not such a whisper campaign. We're going to start a whisper campaign. We're going to make sure everyone has heard about Paul Muad'Dib. Oh, yeah, he's got that other name, too, the one Stilgarth calls him, that I'm kind of blanking on, the Lisan something.
Yeah, you're Josh. Getting a blank face from me.
Yeah, but he has his own term for him being the one. Being the Messiah as well, the Fremen do. So in order to advance that cause, this is what we're going to start doing. We're going to start converting people, and we're going to start with the most vulnerable. She just says it.
Yeah.
Which is a very common criticism of religion.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting
throughout the ages.
Absolutely.
Right? So I thought that was really interesting. Unfortunately, the more we're exposed to Lady Jessica, the more she does seem to be under some kind of spell, and that humanity, that mother part of her, that part of her that's just a compassionate, empathetic human being who might be wrestling with what she knows she kind of has to do for the sake of her son. And also it's tied to all this stuff with the Bene Gesserit that, of course, she's not extricated herself from. All of that stuff matters. And so that conflict is what should make her so fascinating. But the conflict doesn't seem to be there. She just seems to be full on in possession mode.
Mm-hmm.
I've now been overtaken. You said it well. I've been overtaken by this thought, and I am now operating as if truly under some kind of spell. She becomes less and less interesting the more that seems to be the reality. And even the conversation she then later has with Paul, where they're truly, literally mother and son, I still didn't get enough of that humanity coming through. So I thought that was a miss with her character. It seems like for the same reasons that you said. With Paul, by the end, I came around to the notion that even though the movie seems to make a similar choice with him, where the moment he drinks that poison, he becomes a different person. There's no doubt he becomes a different person. He starts acting differently. He starts behaving in a way that would suggest he's imbued with a special power, and he knows he's the one now, and he's going to start wielding that power. The movie has him on that trajectory, and we see the doubts, we see the disappointment coming from Chani, but by the end, he kind of gives it up, doesn't he? Gives away the secret there, doesn't he, at the end when he says to her, no matter what happens, whatever his exact line is, no matter what happens, know that I've always loved you. To me, that's him saying, hey, this is all for show. And you also said that well. Basically, not that it's all for show. I think there's part of him that is still wrestling with this notion that there's a whole lot of evidence that would suggest he really is the one. Whether or not he fully believes it or not, I think what he believes in is beyond revenge, which I do think that is still an element here for sure. Beyond revenge, what he's interested in is I'm still giving him the credit for wanting to accomplish what he initially wanted to accomplish, which is to liberate the Fremen.
Yeah.
And if being their savior and utilizing the power that he has, whether or not that power means he's truly the one or not, or whether or not the one should even be someone like him, someone who's an outsider, if wielding that power gets him closer to those objectives, then he's going to wield it. And so at the end, what we're seeing there, and what I think about this, last thing I'll say, Josh, is when I watch all of Dune, I'm thinking a lot about one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, and maybe that's why it doesn't quite match up in terms of the human drama and the psychology, because I'm comparing it to Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, and Henry V. And, you know, Shakespeare had 3 plays to play all of this out. We've got Fade Rotha is basically the Hotspur character, the rival to Prince Hal here, assuming the throne. Those similarities are definitely there. And the same way Prince Hal, in assuming the throne and becoming King Henry, understands how to manipulate his position and understands how to play the game to further his agenda, it's very different, but that's kind of how I see what he's doing at the very end of the film. I don't think that this new version of Paul has been completely or even maybe mostly consumed yet by whatever that other power is that's taking him over and that took over his mother. I think he's still battling with it. And at the end, we know that everything he's doing is a ploy. It's an act.
Mm.
That's how I saw it.
Yeah, I guess all the conflict you described, I got more of that before drinking the water of life than I did after. I felt like it flattened him.
Yeah.
That act flattened him, and it's certainly a possibility. What you describe is still there, because, and I hope so for the third part, that, you know, that will make it more interesting. But the presentation is much more flat. I don't see that struggle. I don't see that conflict. And I guess the ploy is less interesting to me in the final third than the struggle of the middle section, where we still saw some of Paul's mm-hmm. actual humanity. But yeah, it's not out of the question that it's possible there at the end. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm agreeing with you in terms of how it's presented. But if you, like me, watch the end of the film and see him as someone who is accepting a role that he thinks is the right role, the role he has to accept, even if he's not totally sure it's who he is, then it re-informs, it recontextualizes those moments that you said seem to be flattened. That's what it did for me anyway, where it's like when he goes and stands in front of the world, all the Fremen on that little stage, and says, I'm the one, and mm-hmm. proclaims himself to be the savior. And he's now this aggressive, warlike character. He's a different Paul, the different Paul that Chani is judging for becoming the way she didn't want him to become, but feared he probably would. At least that's how I read it. In the moment, you're watching that thinking, oh, he's just like his mother. He's just become possessed by this, and that's who he is now. The end made me rethink that. And when I watch, or when I think about that scene now, the wrestling isn't in him literally wrestling, but I'm watching those scenes now in my mind or playing them back and thinking about a character who doesn't fully believe everything he's saying and yet has to sell it as convincingly as he does. And that makes those scenes actually imbued with a certain tension.
And you think that's in the performance? Because you've been critical of his performance, because that's a lot of intricacy to those moments that I don't know that. I think Chalamet is fine, but I don't know that he's bringing it there in those scenes.
But those scenes you're talking about, this is kind of my point. I think it's a hard thing, even with spoilers, to really maybe fully get this across. But what I'm saying is, for him to be as convincing as he is
mm-hmm.
as that new character,
no
internal conflict coming through at all, because it can't. For him to fully sell it to the people and convince them that he is the Messiah, there can't be any of that doubt. He has to act as if he has no doubt. In the moment, I think the absence of doubt means that the movie isn't giving him enough complexity. But when I get to the end of the film and I see, oh, he's actually still Paul, he still loves Chani, but he's going to do all of this to move this forward.
Okay.
That then makes that act of having no doubt and being so convincing a tremendous acting job by him, and it then also an acting job by the character.
Right.
It also means, like, think about what it would mean to be that person in the moment, to not believe what you're saying, but have to render it that way.
Yeah. So what's the part at the end? I think this is where I'm getting tripped up, that convinces mm-hmm. you he's still Paul.
Well, maybe I'm reading too much into it, Josh, but he turns to her right before he turns to Chani. Right before he turns to the Emperor and turns to Florence Pugh and says, I'm going to take her hand and rule the galaxy.
Oh, that's right.
He turns to Chani and says, whatever happens, know that I've always loved you.
Yeah.
And the way I interpreted that was him saying, hey, you're not going to like what's about to happen.
Gotcha.
But don't worry about it too much. Now, the movie, of course, still shows that she is going to worry about it.
Of course, yeah.
As you would expect. But again, maybe I'm putting too much
no,
into
no,
it,
no,
Josh,
that's in play. That's
that
in play.
That seemed to betray, maybe or the wrong word there, but that seemed to suggest what his psychology right. in that moment really was. Now, it doesn't mean what makes us complicated is that he is still someone in that moment who, for whatever it means to not fully believe that you're the one or embrace that internally, psychologically, as the Messiah, he still, like everyone else, can't deny that he has certain powers
right.
and abilities.
No, I think that's one of the interesting things about
right.
this whole narrative.
Yeah, so acting on them seems to suggest that he then must believe who he is because he's utilizing the powers, but maybe it is more complicated than that. Maybe he's utilizing the powers, but in utilizing the powers, he's walking that line between belief and non-belief, or it's kind of like
he's testing him out. I mean, in some ways, he's testing him out.
He's testing it out, or it's sort of like, you know, it's hard not to watch this movie sometimes and think of other things like Star Wars too, and see a character who you're kind of embracing the dark side. And even if you're embracing the dark
side
and you know you're embracing the dark side, but guess what? Even if you're doing it knowingly, you embrace it too much, you might be consumed by it and eventually it destroys you. That's the tension I think the movie wants to display. And I guess because of the end, I was able to look back on those scenes in a different way.
Mm.
But
no, the dark
I'd
side
love to
comparison.
Hear others' thoughts.
Yeah, the dark side comparison is a good one. It came to mind for me as well. And I think that's what I was looking for, is a little bit more of that internal struggle that mm-hmm. we see in, and you know, Mark Hamill's Luke Skywalker, not my greatest sci-fi performance ever, but I think we do see that, especially in something like Return of the Jedi, that allure of the dark side and the push-pull. I will say this about Chalamet's performance, back to the scene you were talking about where he walks into that room and claims power, and it's him against like 1,000. Right.
Yes.
And what I liked about it is Chalamet is somewhat similar to Kyle MacLachlan in sort of performative stature, let's say. And I just remember that being one of the really low points of David Lynch's Dune is when we're supposed to buy Kyle MacLachlan as this, you know, this warrior king figure, messianic warrior king. And I don't remember how the Lynch scene plays out. Maybe there's something like this and it didn't just register for me. But the choice they make in this scene with Chalamet is it's not that he shouts them down, but it's that he singles out one person. And a person who is like a tough dude, like who could probably mm-hmm. take him out. And he looks him in the eyes. And again, it's been a while. I'm remembering the exact exchange. But somehow relating to him using those powers of knowing about his life story, his experience, and winning over that one person. And it's not shouting down the 1,000.
No.
It's winning over the one.
Yes.
And that was just a nicely handled way of eliding the fact that Willy Wonka's not going to come in here and tell all these warriors what's up. But maybe he'll come in and establish a relationship with an influential one of them that will trickle then, you know, throughout the crowd. So it was just thinking about Lynch's Dune. To me, this was like, okay, this is like a course, maybe not correction, but alteration that really does work.
Well, all of that's true. But at the same time, he does still have to stand in that room and be a commanding enough. And
he shouts.
And he does shout. And I'll say maybe not exactly the right word, but he has to be a menacing or intimidating enough presence ultimately for all of those people to think that he can be their leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't totally convinced that Chalamet, based on the performance in Dune Part One, when it came time to do that, I wasn't quite sure that he could deliver. And I thought he did deliver in that scene. I'm with you on sort of just the stature, and he is naturally very, very boyish, and he has to take on some tones there that I wasn't sure he might be able to hit. But I want to say something else about that scene real quick, because it isn't quite an apples to apples scenario, because we know, or at least I think we know, that Paul really does have some superpowers and he had no way to rig the game. But what I liked about that scene, as we've talked about the way Dune in general, and especially this part, explores this notion of religion and its function over the centuries in society, and ultimately what the movie would say, in a lot of cases, oppressing people, or people in power using it to oppress and exploit.
Manipulate, yeah.
And manipulate. That scene is straight out of the televangelist handbook. That is the scene where the televangelist who wants everyone in the room to believe that they're a representative of God and can heal or do magic things like Jesus. They find someone in the crowd who is in a wheelchair and they make them stand, Josh, or they've got the headaches. They've got the headaches that won't go away, the migraines, and he touches the head and be gone, Satan. And that's that same move.
For sure.
Where that person is there being a skeptic in this case, and he singles them out and says, I know your pain. I know everything you're thinking. Here's the truth. Here's the gospel. And in making him believe and performing that miracle on him, everyone else in the room goes, it's true.
Yeah.
He's a miracle worker.
And so you're talking about a con man. And I guess this goes back to the water of life thing is I would have found that more compelling if he had not drank the water of life and been under some sort of influence and had been playing the con man completely consciously. Mm-hmm. I think that's a more interesting dynamic. And again, maybe I'm just misunderstanding this whole water of life concept. I'm only going by what's presented in this movie. But to me, it was more like he was not playing a con man so much as enacting this state of hypnosis, some sort of controlling factor, which, you know, the scene, as I said, worked, but it doesn't have that dynamic of I'm trying to pull something or I'm conflicted about this, which the televangelist element would absolutely have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not really a con if ultimately you have the power to see all of that and it's true. Right.
So right.
That is the other layer to this.
Well, and that's one of the complications that makes this whole, you know, the savior figure interesting is that there are these powers that he has. What does that mean? And that's not something, I'm not saying this is a fault of this film that's not entirely answered. Perhaps it will be in the next installment.
Yeah, for better or for worse, the other pop culture story that I couldn't shake watching this film that I hadn't thought about at all watching Dune Part One. And when we talked about it, I mentioned I was a little too aware the second time around with Dune Part One of the hodgepodge of mythologies that were coming together. This time, it's that line that I think did Sam either have it in the billboard I think it's in the billboard about the narrow path. I was instantly in that moment watching the film. I was like, oh, this thing that you're describing, this moment where he drinks the water and then seems to become someone different and all of his choices just seem to be made for him. You know who and what I thought of? I thought about Stephen Strange and Marvel. It's the MCU. It's Stephen Strange at some point. He's the only person who sees all 4 million different variations of how this could play out. And there's only one path to success. And it means making all these extremely difficult choices.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
He's Stephen Strange, who now has to coldly and callously enact his power and make choices that even seem to fundamentally go against his nature, because he's seen the water has given him the vision to see the only one path to success.
And I think that's the easy answer. Like we're probably going to get feedback from people more, schooled and invested in Dune mythology, is that this water of life has simply enhanced the powers that were already there. That's, you know, if that's the explanation, I get it. Makes sense. I should probably move on.
Yeah. But in fairness to you, and hopefully to me as well, the entire first half of this movie and all of Dune Part One is about him not being sure of his
destiny, his conflict,
and who he really is in his conflict. So the movie does want to wrestle with that. Certainly, poses that as a key part of this narrative. Okay, somehow we talked about spoilers surrounding Dune Part Two more than we talked about Dune Part Two during our review.
I mean, it's that kind of movie, isn't it?
It is kind of that kind of movie. Well, hope that was enlightening for someone out there.
It was for me. Thank you. If nothing else, you helped me a bit.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting Archive, going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.